Welcome to Useful Idiots. I'm Katie Halper.
I'm Matt Taibbi.
And we are very excited about today's show. We're going to be talking to journalist, CPA, and former congressional candidate Crystal Ball.
Excellent.
And I wanted to make sure that people knew, in case you're watching this, we are a podcast. And you can rate and review us and subscribe. You just go to iTunes, Spotify, Apple Podcasts.
You're looking at me like I
like
know.
Like you know.
I
don't know. Yeah. Well, yeah. We just wanted to make sure that you knew about it because we're video also. And if you're listening to this, you may want to check us out on video at YouTube. And you can then subscribe to us on YouTube. The point is, though, tell your friends about it. Give us a good rating because together we can beat Pod Save America.
Yeah, I'm starting to embrace this whole let's, you know.
Beat Pod Save America.
Yeah, exactly.
Last week, by the way, when we had Amo Bernie, as he's known to people who speak Arabic, which means Uncle Bernie, when we had him on, I was, because I didn't have my laptop because it was a bonus thing and it was last minute, and I was looking on my phone, and I think I said I'm looking on my phone to look things up, don't think I'm being distracted.
Yeah, everybody was slaughtering you about that.
I know!
I could have defended you, but I didn't.
That's
I just kind of let it
Wait,
out.
Yeah. Don't waste your defense on me on this. I can take this. But listen, guys, and if you're listening to the podcast, you don't know this, I'm looking straight into the camera. I was looking things up, and whoever said that it's triggering when someone's not paying their full undivided attention, good. I want to trigger you more. Tell me what
All
else
right.
triggers
Let's look
you.
On our phones while we do the
yeah,
rest of the show
seriously,
now.
How precious is that?
Let's not even look at each other. All right, so the four food groups of news, what do we have this week? And what do we have in Republican Suck this week?
Okay, so as listeners, viewers know, we have this shtick where we have, there are four types of stories, right?
There's only four.
Four,
so there's Republican Suck, Democrats Suck, isn't that horrible, isn't that weird?
Yeah, so for Republican Suck, we have Trump basically kicking off a homelessness campaign, and this is from Washington Post. Trump has recently directed his aides to figure out how the hell we can get these people off the streets, according to one administration official.
And he's saying, they're basically saying policing is going to be
yes.
an important tool.
Yeah, policing may be an important tool to help get them off the street.
Yeah, and this is going to bring us back to the 80s and 90s. Trump is already like a throwback to
right.
the 80s and 90s.
Big time, yeah.
Right? When we elected, we were basically electing like early 90s spy magazine
right.
characters.
Yes.
And
Gordon Gekko plus...
Exactly.
Humor,
yeah. Short-fingered vulgarian.
Yes.
And this exact same thing happened in the early 90s when homelessness was suddenly it was like a chic issue among both the left and the right. And the right-wing solution was exactly what Trump was proposing, which was enhanced policing. The people who sort of founded community policing, Stop and Frisk, the little-known New York City Police Commissioner Howard Safer, who is known here in New York as the odorless and colorless Howard Safer. He came up with this plan to, quote, we will either summons them or arrest them.
Mm.
And this is essentially, I think, what's being envisaged with this new idea where, like, homelessness is bad, so we're going to have cops arrest people
right.
for things like blocking traffic or trespassing,
right.
you know, failure to obey a police order. And so we're not going to see homeless people for a while, and then there's going to be phony outrage, and then people will forget because they won't see homeless people.
So there'll be a small window of opportunity to actually to care or pretend to care.
Democrats suck. This is sort of more of a general observation. This whole Kavanaugh thing. It's every time this issue comes up with Justice Kavanaugh, it reminds me of like a Three Stooges episode when you see them like about to do a construction project, and if you see them have like a vice grip and you know somebody's head is going to end up being sawed off, or like they just make a mess of every element of these stories. And you know, when this latest Kavanaugh thing came out, immediately you could see that the Democratic Party was going to be cleaved into camps that were for and against making a big deal of it. And then the story came out, and immediately there's elected members who are arguing about whether or not to pursue it, which is unseemly. You just don't see the Republicans doing that as much. And then the story fell apart in the media, right? The New York Times reporting of it.
Yeah, they had a story over the weekend, right?
Right.
Saying that some more people heard about a woman, Deborah Ramirez, accounting
right.
having a penis thrust in her face.
Yes.
Right?
The word penis is prominent in this story.
Yeah, yeah, prominent penis. And then the New York Times, which broke this story, right, tweeted, having a penis thrust in your face at a drunken dorm party may seem like harmless fun. But
Who
when
wrote
Brett
that?
Kavanaugh did it to her, Deborah Ramirez said, it confirmed that she didn't belong at Yale in the first place. I mean, that's part of it, but it also is just bad to have a penis thrust in your face, whether or not it confirms some inner narrative you have about whether you belong at an Ivy League institution.
Yeah, I hadn't made the connection to, first of all, that tweet, harmless fun.
Harmless fun, good old fashioned. It's better than saying good old fashioned fun, though.
Right.
That would have been even better.
but then on top of that, they made a mess of the reporting of it, because the story that came out, it turns out that there were a couple of elements that were kind of left out of the reporting of the piece, which of course instantly were seized upon by, you know, the Daily Caller, and they had forgotten to mention the fact that the person who was said to be the victim in all this apparently told friends that she didn't recall the incident, which is, it's understandable, yeah. But it's also kind of something you have to put in there if you're doing the story. But the worst part of it was then the reporters themselves went on MSNBC and were talking about things that their editors left out and put in, which makes it all look like a mess.
Right.
So the whole thing just turned into a fiasco. It's like, politically, it's a loser for the Democrats because they look divided.
Right. And they also really dropped the ball, so to speak, when they didn't catch him in real time lying. Brett Kavanaugh was lying. Like, Nathan Robinson wrote a great piece about this, really meticulous piece at Current Affairs, just going through, not lying about like what happened even, although that was a lie, but contradicting himself.
Right.
And they didn't do anything about it. And they could have nailed him on it. The best part of that whole thing was him talking about his father and tearing up, because his calendar story was so unconvincing. Like, I have my calendar
right here, and it didn't say
sexually assaulted anyone to do sexually assault someone.
That was on a different calendar.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Uh-huh. And he's like, why do I keep why do I use my calendar so much? It's because my dad, he used a calendar and he would talk about his calendar at Christmas. He used to regale us with stories, but it sounded like a weird abusive relationship, first of all.
With a calendar?
Yeah, just like it seemed like they were traumatized by the dad's calendar. Like, it's played way too big a role in the family traditions and holidays.
Why did I keep calendars? My dad started keeping detailed calendars of his life in 1978. He did so as both a calendar and a diary. He's a very organized guy, to put it mildly.
But then his dad wasn't even dead. He was in the room. He was in the Senate hearing. So it's like, is it that moving to you, really, that your dad likes calendars, that you're going to get teary-eyed over it?
Right.
Oh, he was the worst.
And then, the background of this whole thing is they're arguing over whether or not they should pull out all the stops to stop the Kavanaugh's appointment, and yet they still haven't gotten past the fact that they didn't do anything with the Merrick Garland episode, which renders all of this kind of moot in a way. So it's just a mess all the way around.
Also, Ben Shapiro did dismiss allegations of sexual assault. You heard this, right? Against Brett Kavanaugh. Did you hear about this?
No, I didn't.
Oh, can I just play this quickly?
We've had a bevy of public figures in recent years who have had their genitalia described on national television by people who allege sexual assault. Right, Stormy Daniels famously described President Trump's genitalia. Bill Clinton's genitalia. Details of such were talked about. Nobody has yet described Kavanaugh's genitalia. Now, that's not dispositive. Maybe they were generic. Who knows? But the bottom line is we've had no corroborating details on any of these stories. All of them apparently happened in public places with other witnesses available, and not one witness has been there who corroborates any of these stories.
With penis descriptions. So what?
So if somebody had come forward and said it looks like a narwhal horn or something like that.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, I would like to. Where is it? What is it? You draft someone. Like, I don't want him on our team. Like, I want to kick him off the Jewish team.
Oh, you want to cut him?
Yeah, cut him.
Okay.
Cut him. Oh, cut him. Cut him, genitalia, Jewish. Guys. Wow.
Wow. Okay. All right. So what do we have for, isn't that weird?
So according to the New York Daily News, a woman in Houston, a beauty-obsessed woman, they say, which is an unfair characterization.
Yeah, that was a strange...
Right?
Yeah.
A beauty-obsessed woman apparently decided that aging was not an option when she was caught on tape breaking into a Texas spa with a power saw to steal anti-aging products, authorities said. Police in the Houston suburb of Sugarland are now on the hunt for a suspect in the Botox heist, which happened around 8:30 p.m. Friday at Botox RN Med Spa. The three-minute surveillance video shared by police this week shows a woman desperately trying to force herself into the business without using any tools. The thief was not wearing a mask or gloves. After failing to open the front door with her bare hands, the woman brought her SUV closer to the spa and took a battery-powered grinding saw to cut into the door, the footage shows. The video does not show her leaving the facility, but police said she walked out with a number of anti-aging products. And they then give a description. They say she was... Well,
the thing is, you don't need a description. So what's amazing about this is that they have this all in video,
right?
And it's a very clear... They show that she's in a Mercedes SUV, right?
With no front license plate.
No front license plate. And she and you can see this woman's face. She's dressed in like a pink top and sweatpants, right? And you can see her very clearly. Like, clear, if you know this person, it's obvious that you could recognize her. And so she can't get in. And so she goes back and gets the power saw.
She's pretty resourceful, though.
Yeah. But so this happened a couple of weeks ago. And this was broadcast all over the news.
Oh, yeah. It did happen in
Houston. And what I thought was interesting is I saw this story a while ago, and they haven't caught her yet.
Right.
And I feel like...
They offered a reward. The spa has offered a reward.
The spa, $5,000. I want to reach out to this person. Like, I don't know. I just feel bad about her.
Yeah. You know? Should we offer... Do you think Rolling Stone will put up some money for us to offer an award to her?
to pay for the other... I don't know. I mean, don't you just... It's a heartbreaking story, right?
We
should just tell her that it's okay. She doesn't need Botox.
I know, but we'd be lying because the world is so harsh and so, you know, superficial.
Right.
But beauty does shine from inside.
Right.
So
basically, we want the Useful Idiots audience to look at this video, and if you know her, to help us reach out to her so that we can tell her it's okay and we can start to...
Yeah, we could have her do... Maybe she could even, like... do consulting, give us makeup tips.
Right,
or
skin
tips.
Yeah.
She could also give us some of the products that
stole. We could sample.
What if she's still in there, though? They say that they didn't see her leaving on the footage, so what if she's still in there sampling stuff in the basement or something?
She's trapped. Anyway, isn't that horrible?
Take it away.
Yeah, do you want seals or pigs?
Oh, God, I love pigs. I like both of them, though.
You got to pick one. It's unfortunate.
Both of them get killed?
I mean, it's bad, yeah.
Let's I like
seals.
Pigs more.
All right. Well, then we have a problem with seal deaths in the Bering Strait. They're seeing 5 times as many bearded seals dying, and they don't have a cause for that. And so, why are we telling you this? It's not to inform you. This is a news program, and essentially, what we're trying to tell you to do is that the entire world outside of your broadcast experience is unsafe. The oceans are basically cauldrons of death.
Right.
You shouldn't go swimming in them. You should stay at home and listen to podcasts all day, and specifically
this one.
So, because whatever's going on, and they don't know what it is in the Pacific Ocean, but it's killing seals, which are a much stronger animal than you are. So,
oh, really? That's a good point.
Yeah.
They're just more robust?
They're more, I mean, like, they're animals, right?
Right.
Yeah. So,
they don't need, like, Netflix.
So, seals are dying at 5 times the usual rate. Don't go outside and listen to the podcast. All right. So, that's the news this week.
Yeah.
What do we have? We have homelessness is coming back briefly. Then the Kavanaugh thing is continuing to be a mess for the Democrats. Then Botox lady still at large, and everything is killing animals outside of your house, and don't go outside. All right, so a couple of news items I think are worth talking about this week, and some of them are undercovered. A couple of them are things that I've written about before, so I thought it'd be interesting to talk about. One that really caught my eye was a story: Google changes algorithm to prioritize quote original reporting, and this is a thing that I think a lot of Americans are not aware of, was sort of informal, unelected regulation of how media works. Google, since the 2016 election, has changed the way that it shows you the news or search results appear a couple of times in a big way, and people don't realize it. And it's had a huge impact on how we see the news. And the first one was I think in 2018 when they elevated authority over familiarity. So the idea was that they have all these sort of human reviewers who go through all the content and they score it. There's a survey that creates the algorithm, but it stresses things like, does the source have awards? Has the source been recognized by, you know, as a journalistic authority? And then it downplays other things. So the example, when I called them up to ask them how this worked, they said, like, for instance, if you type in baseball in Google, in the old days, it might have showed you like Little League, your local Little League. It would show you like the baseball league that's like closest to you, or, you know, it would be some other thing. Now it shows you MLB.com, Major League Baseball, because that's, you know, that's sort of the big recognized authority. And so obviously the impact this has is that it stresses big sort of commercial news organizations over smaller independents. And you saw when this happened the first time, all these websites, these independent alternative websites, saw huge drops in traffic, like World Socialist Website, Alternate, Global Research, Consortium, Socialist Worker, Media Matters, Common Dreams. They all saw precipitous falls of like 30-40% in traffic, like almost overnight when this happened last time. So they've done this again. Right? So that was like last year, and now, or the year before, and now they've done originality is the new thing. And what that's going to be, that's going to end up accentuating results and clicks for news organizations that have the budget to produce original reporting, which on the one hand is good, but on the other hand is going to severely devalue probably people who are commenting on things, who are independent. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing. I think people don't realize that it's going on.
Right. Or aggregators, right?
Aggregators are going to be punished.
Like Common Dreams, for instance.
Common Dreams.
A big one, which I've written for.
It's pretty clear that these new algorithms, they really, really punish independent alternative media pretty severely, and they have a direct impact on their bottom line because, you know, search results result in traffic, which results in money, right?
Yeah. And we talked about this once on my show about how one of the disturbing things about the way these things are kind of evaluated is that you get the official versions that are distortions of reality, those kind of get a pass.
Right.
So like if you're a reputable site or a reputable news organization, then and you write, you know, about WMDs like Judith Miller, right? She would get like a big pass at the time from something
that's
this.
Like a deviation, right? So they consider that sort of an oopsie. Right. But if you're a person who writes about chemtrails, like, you know, you're sifted out.
Sure,
completely.
Right. Not that we're big chem. We're not.
No,
a big
no, of course
but, yeah,
not.
But
no.
It is. It, in some ways, it's more. It's scary because, like, by virtue of
the imprimatur of these things.
The word,
No, that's exactly the problem. Is that you think that you're getting a vetted product,
right? Exactly.
And you're not.
Right.
You're just getting something that's less vetted by reputation.
Right.
Right. And you're it's unconsciously sending you messages about what's more authoritative and what isn't when it's really not correct. You know, I mean, the old system basically charged the consumer, the newsreader, with making decisions about who was more reliable and who wasn't. Right.
If you
liked that newspaper, you read it more.
Yeah.
Right. If you felt they were reliable, now they're making that decision for you a little ahead of time, which is a little scary. But there's a larger issue here, which is that, you know, it's much easier to have control over how people see the news now under the guise of we're trying to improve the consumer experience and keep you away from fake news.
Right.
But we'll also, you won't see Consortium as much or the World Socialist Website, you know, whatever it is. So that happened. Yeah. So one more story that was interesting, and I wrote about this a couple of years ago, and it's a convoluted, difficult story, and it's basically not covered in the news very much, but it's really interesting to me, mainly because it's undercovered. During the financial crisis, one of the stories that I followed because it was part of things that I was covering involving the bailout was the fate of Fannie and Freddie, which are the, you know, the big housing authorities. And these are quasi-public companies, quasi-private, essentially. They fulfill a utility-like function, but they were essentially private companies. And they're enormous. You could make an argument that together, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are the biggest financial company in the world. They have about $200 billion in revenues annually. So that's above Bank of China, above Wells Fargo, JP Morgan Chase. After they were bailed out in 2008, the government gave them about $187 billion. And the bailout was really bizarre. Originally, it gave the government an 80% stake and a 10% dividend. So they were supposed to give a piece of their revenues every year. And then a couple of years after the bailout, it was sort of unilaterally decided that, no, we're going to change the terms of the bailout. We just want all the money that you make. And so the government got this thing that's called the net worth sweep, where essentially the terms of the bailout now say that the government gets 100% of all net revenue that goes to Fannie and Freddie, which obviously made people who are shareholders in the company a little upset because, you know, they're now being disenfranchised. And there are a couple of things that are weird about this. One is that it seems not to be legal on multiple levels. The government is only allowed to get money through taxation, and the only authority that's allowed to do that is Congress. The other thing is nobody knows where this money goes, and it's an enormous sum of money. You know, just in 1 year alone, there was $130 billion, which is like real money even by government standards.
Right.
So there's been this huge court case about this that has gone on. There's been a multiple, actually. and it really hasn't been covered. And it's been a back and forth fight between the government and the Federal Housing Finance Authority, which is the regulator that oversees this bailout. And finally, the first week of September, a federal circuit judge ruled that the FHFA, which oversees Fannie and Freddie, is an unconstitutional authority. And this means, to make a long story short, that sometime in the next probably 30 days or so, there's going to be a decision probably about ending this crazy arrangement, at which point I thought maybe we could have somebody on to talk about this.
Yeah.
But it's
Fannie or Freddie.
It's Fannie Gate. It's a crazy story. And it's interesting to me because it's a sum of money that normally you would see talked about a lot in the media.
Right.
And it's one of the biggest companies in the world. And there's basically like two stories about this.
So how much money is it again?
So the Fannie and Freddie, their annual revenues are probably north of $200 billion.
Okay.
So that would make it together the largest.
Right. Like envision or conceptualize what that is in relationship to other things. Like,
well, if you think about the federal, let's say the military budget.
Sure.
Is $737 billion.
Okay.
Right? So you're talking about like a third or a fourth of
right.
that. So it's an enormous sum of money, right? But the interesting thing is it's hard really to get answers about any of this stuff. It's not on the budget anywhere, and it's just a crazy, crazy story that doesn't get reported very much.
I'm torn because I like that they're getting their money taken away from them.
You do?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Okay, why?
Because aren't they bad?
Fannie and Freddie had a lot of problems, and the leadership of the company was deeply corrupt, I mean, pre-2000 especially.
Right.
But Fannie and Freddie, on their own, they fulfill a pretty valuable role in society. They help a lot of people buy houses. That's
okay.
kind of what their mandate
right.
is. And they make a lot of money, but it has a sort of utility-like function in society.
Mm-hmm.
Without it would be really tough for the housing markets to function. Just taking the money
right.
would be a pretty, pretty crazy precedent.
Yeah.
Because if they could do that with, the thing is, they didn't do that with other companies.
Right.
They bailed out lots of other private
right.
companies.
Well, maybe that's what we should be fighting for is theft from more companies.
We should take it from all
yeah,
of them.
Yeah, we should take it from more.
Goldman.
Yeah.
And
it's
JP Morgan
it's the opposite. Exactly. And it's the opposite of, the Felicity Huffman story, right?
Right.
Where she was sentenced to 2 weeks or something.
Right.
For this doing something way worse than what a black working class mother did. This black woman like literally used her father's address so that her kid could get into a better school.
In 2011, Kelly Williams Bolar, an African American single mother from Akron, Ohio, was sentenced to 5 years in jail for using her father's home address to get her kids into a better school district. That sentence was ultimately suspended to just 10 days in jail and 3 years probation. Many argue that Bolar is not that different from actress Felicity Huffman, who was sentenced this week for paying to inflate her daughter's SAT scores. Both did what they did to get a better education for their children. That is the argument we've heard. But there is one difference, the punishment. Huffman was sentenced to just 14 days for her role in the college admission scandal. 2 weeks.
But you see online, at least, there's this tendency to be like, she should go to jail for longer, as opposed to, it's like a race to the bottom. Like,
right.
No, we want other people to not go to jail for as long.
Right, yeah, exactly. When I wrote the book, The Divide, lot of what I was looking at was people were saying, well, yes, all these companies that committed fraud in the subprime mortgage markets, like, they should all go to jail. I'm not necessarily sure that was the answer. There should have been some punishment.
Yeah.
But the big thing is people were actually going to jail for welfare fraud.
Right.
Right? So
yes.
You're talking about people who are, for $200, $300,
right.
or there's something silly like a woman is receiving welfare because she's claiming to be a single mother and the inspector finds that she has a boyfriend at
right.
home who's contributing and then she gets in trouble
right,
and
yeah.
loses her kids.
Yeah, I mean, awful
yeah,
stuff. Yeah.
That's the stuff we want to
right,
stop.
Exactly.
Right,
exactly. Not in the other direction.
Yeah, necessarily.
Right. Yeah,
yeah.
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, as you can see, I'm for, confiscating the property of companies.
Yeah.
But I do think that I get, maybe in theory, I get how it could work as a deterrent almost, not as a deterrent for, but it's a question of enforcement and judges just decide on it. Remember Affluenza, which was that disease that this wealthy white kid had who like mowed a bunch of people down, DUI.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I remember
yeah.
that. Yeah, yeah.
And people like want him to go to jail for a lot longer. And of course, I totally get it. And maybe I get how it's part of the theory is like, if we punish make this more punishable and richer white people are subjected to it, then maybe people will support reform.
Right.
But I think it's a question of there's so much discretion anyway.
Yeah.
That it's not going to work.
I don't think you have to. If you just take the example of the financial crisis, for instance, you have people who are committing, for instance, fraud in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
Right.
So if there are people in jail for fraud, for welfare fraud, for instance, somebody has to probably go to jail for stealing $300 or $400 billion.
They be freed. The welfare people.
If you're gonna put somebody in jail, make it, you know, at least a few symbolic cases probably would change behavior pretty quickly, and then people might think about criminal justice reform too.
Right, exactly. You
know, so it would be a win-win. I think you just got to make it more even, no matter what it is.
Right.
Yeah. So okay. So that's so we're going to be talking to Crystal Ball.
Yeah, who's great. She's done some really great monologues on her show Rising, which is on Hill TV. She's done some great monologues about MSNBC, about Russiagate. She's talked about the Bernie Bro narrative. She's talked about media bias. She ran for Congress in 2010. Then she was on the cycle on MSNBC. We're also going to talk to her about this really great appearance she had on Real Time with Bill Maher. She's just really, she's very fierce.
Great. Well, let's talk to her.
Yeah, let's talk to her. Welcome, Crystal Ball. Thank you so much for joining us. We've been wanting to have you on since the beginning.
Welcome.
Aw. Well, I would not say this if, like, I just thought the podcast sucked. I would just not say anything.
Right.
But it's actually really, really good.
Thank you. It has
improved my life to have you guys to listen to in the car. So thank you.
Wow, fantastic. I think that's our first sort of promo.
Yeah, that's great.
Thank you so much.
That goes on the blurb when we write the book.
Right, exactly.
Useful idioting.
Right,
Useful idiots, yeah.
Right, useful idiots for idiots.
Yeah,
right,
useful idiots for idiots. Yeah, we definitely got to do that, So you were on Real Time with Bill Maher the other day. And you had a kind of viral moment where Bill Maher kind of unbelievably suggested that the compromise candidate who could beat Donald Trump was Amy Klobuchar.
And they need a compromise candidate. I'm looking hard at Amy Klobuchar. You know why? Because, like, this is not an insult to Amy Klobuchar. I like you. But when they put generic Democrat on the ballot, they win.
There's an amazing shot of Crystal. You're like, it looks like you're trying not to either throw up or laugh. Unclear which one, maybe both. Can you tell us about that moment and about the point that you made?
Hold on a
wokesters,
second.
And then she's
Why do you think that economic populism, whatever you want to call it, socialism, democratic socialism, et cetera, Medicare for all, is so unpopular when a poll just came out that had Bernie Sanders beating Trump in Texas by more than any of the other candidates? The last 20 polls have shown Bernie Sanders beating Trump. And here's the other thing, though.
Meaning
that you don't need a centrist to win. Centrism is why we have lost. It's why we lost 1,000 state house seats. It's why we lost the White House. We ran a centrist. But we lost. I mean, you know, what went viral really was that face. Like, my face went viral because I just, you know, I reacted and the cameraman happened to catch my look, because it's just so absurd to think that the way we should go about trying to win as Democrats is by running a centrist. We ran a centrist last time. And we lost. Not only that, but if you look over the course of the 8 years of the Obama administration, Obama did not run as a centrist. He ran as a transformational candidate. We won. And then as he governed as a centrist, we proceeded to lose most of the country, the House, the Senate, and then ultimately the White House. So, look, I think Bill Maher is like a very well-intentioned guy. He's a nice guy. He's really thoughtful. He's really trying to figure out what the right path forward is here. But I just think there's such a mentality that is constantly reinforced in the media that you have to have a centrist to win, that any sort of facts and data that you put up against that, it just like goes in one ear and comes out the other.
I mean, having covered campaigns for a long time, don't you think this is just sort of conventional wisdom that gets tossed back and forth between reporters because that's what they think? I mean, they've been repeating a lot of these campaign cliches to each other for so long that the only way to win, it's like this 1996 paradigm that you have to be somewhere between a Republican and a Democrat to get the most possible votes. But the electorate has completely changed, especially recently, and it seems like people in the press especially haven't caught on to that, right?
Yeah, and I think there's a generational issue where there's a certain generation of Democrats that was just so scarred by like Dukakis and then Clinton being able to win. But again, Clinton's actual first campaign, he ran as an economic populist.
Right.
He did not run as the counter-scheduling, like triangulating, focus group tested thing that he's come to be
known as. But I actually think it goes deeper than that with the media, because you have to think about who the media is trying to reach, right? Who advertisers in the media are trying to reach. They're trying to reach this sort of affluent neoliberal base that's very comfortable being liberal on social issues, right, but is not so comfortable being populist on economic issues, right? The sort of white, affluent, upper middle class. And that's a very small segment, ultimately, of society, but they're very much disproportionately reflected by and represented in the media. And they're the ones that love to hear, like, let's be socially liberal, but let's group on Social Security, let's not raise the minimum wage, nobody wants universal health care, despite the fact that poll after poll after poll says the exact opposite.
Right. So do you think these people know this and are being disingenuous, or are they just so cut off from the way people actually think and feel?
I don't think it's disingenuous. I really don't. I think it is what they genuinely believe. Because you have to think about, we're so influenced by who we're surrounded by, right? So I've talked about this in the context of Bernie Sanders' campaign. I think a big part of the reason why he's treated with such dismissive contempt by most of the media is because his supporters are disproportionately working class. Mm-hmm. His donors are, the number one employer of his donors is Walmart, right? They're Walmart workers, they're teachers. And these are just not the people who the media is surrounded by. They don't know these Walmart workers. Right. So they just can't wrap their head around the fact that he really has a base and really has an appeal.
And you've written in your book, there's an amazing moment where you talk a little bit about the disconnectedness and cluelessness of this particular group of people. I love your description of what you call the nerd prom, the White House Correspondents' Dinner. And you made a great point in the book that really the White House Correspondents' Dinner, you could blame the entire catastrophe of modern America on that 2011 event. Was it 2011 where Obama went after Trump?
All kidding aside, obviously we all know about your credentials and breadth of experience. For example, just recently, in an episode of Celebrity Apprentice.
Yeah, it's this incredible moment where, you know, Trump, who has the ultimate chip on his shoulder, who has always been the guy from the boroughs rather than Manhattan News.
Totally.
Always wanted to fit in and never has. And here he goes to the nerve center of the political elite and is just laughed out of the room. And so much stems from that. But it's also a metaphor for the way that, for what he actually shares in common with his base. Because a lot of people said, this guy's a billionaire. Like, he doesn't get you. He doesn't understand you. But they saw themselves in him because they saw another guy who'd been viewed with contempt by the elites in the country. And the reality is, and this is not, you know, this is a bipartisan sentiment. The Democrats, it's not just a Republican thing. They really have looked at the working class, the multiracial working class, in this paternalistic, condescending, contempt-filled way.
People always talk about how Donald Trump and his base, they don't have anything naturally in common. He's a billionaire and all that. But as you point out, what they do have in common is disdain for that particular group of people, right? Like the people who are walking on the red carpet into the White House Correspondents' Ball. And I think that was great, the way you put that in the book.
Michelle Wolf at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, I don't know if you saw that, but she kind of made a similar argument about how these people help create Trump in some ways. In fact, she said at one point, do you guys have a crush on Trump? Because you're obsessed with him. You won't stop talking about him.
Well, I think that's right, because it's you're either ignoring the sort of multiracial working class of the country entirely, or you're treating them as like some anthropological study.
Right.
It's never like, coverage is about you for you. It's like, look at these exotic creatures.
Exactly.
Or it's contempt, or it's completely invisible.
And how did your biography affect the way that you view these things? Speaking of talking about something like it's an anthropological study, but
I mean, you know, I'm in this car talking to you because I still live in my hometown in rural Virginia where there is really no broadband access. You know, I grew up in Red America. I still live in a town in Virginia that is overwhelmingly Trump supporting. But the part of my life that was most influential for me politically was when I was in my early 20s, I moved to this industrial Midwestern town in Ohio. It's called East Liverpool, Ohio. And it used to be known as the pottery capital of the world, all the like dishes and plates in the world were made there, pretty much. That all went overseas to China in the 50s. But there was a steel mill in the next town over with thousands and thousands of good middle-class union jobs. Well, that went away in the 80s. And so now the town is known best for a picture that went viral of, you know, two adults who had OD'd in the front seat with a toddler strapped into a car seat in the back. Just a horrifying image. And I don't want to paint too negative of a picture. I loved living there. I still go back there. I still have many dear friends and neighbors there. But it was my first time living in a town that had seen that kind of complete economic destruction, right? Destruction really wrought by a bipartisan consensus around free trade and corporatism. And as I went up and down the Ohio River there, every single town, it was the same story. So that's really what has sort of informed my politics. You know, I feel like I have one foot in a green room in New York and one foot in the industrial Midwest and one foot in Kentucky, where I also lived for a number of years. So I kind of have lived in both worlds and can see where people come from. One thing that I think people miss as part of this is the difference between economic progressivism and cultural progressivism. Economic progressivism is really not a problem anywhere in the country. I think the social issues are actually more challenging, and the Democratic Party over the years has actually gotten that exactly backward. They've led with the kind of cultural, liberal cultural signaling rather than the economic issues, the progressive populist economic issues that are popular essentially everywhere you go in the country.
And you can lead with those and then kind of like reach people on both of those issues, I think, more than the other way around.
It's about the emphasis. That's exactly right.
What do you think about the Working Families Party endorsing Elizabeth Warren this week?
It's a little baffling. It was a little strange how they rolled it out, right? You know, first they put out that she won 60-some percent, but then we learn how the process works, and 50% of the vote goes to their tens of thousands of members, and 50% of the vote goes to the leadership of the Working Families Party. And unlike last time, they were happy to put out that 80-something percent of the members voted for Bernie Sanders. This time, they don't want to put out who the members actually voted for. So you can kind of read between the lines here. The leadership wanted Warren. They're hedging their political bets. They think she's on the rise. They think she's the one that can sort of be the consensus candidate. The membership is either torn or outright supported Sanders. So, you know, the other piece of this is, whatever you think of Bernie Sanders, he is the candidate who has most consistently actually had a multiracial working class base.
Right.
And Elizabeth Warren has a very different coalition. The more affluent you are, the more likely you are to support Elizabeth Warren. The more highly educated, the more likely you are to support Elizabeth Warren. So it's a little strange, frankly, to see a party that calls itself the Working Families Party not backing the candidate that it's actually backed by working families.
Yeah, it should be like the Working Family Leaders Party, Leadership Party.
Exactly. They should have it's superdelegates. That's basically what they do. They're like, well, we have our own version of superdelegates, and we're going to decide ultimately. Certainly what it looks like.
But I thought Bernie's supporters were all straight white dudes and Bernie bros. And you know, Warren had a diverse like rainbow coalition of intersectionality and stuff. But
Have you seen
people?
She does have her gender pronouns in her Twitter bio. Nothing wrong with
that. Oh, really? I didn't know that. Yeah. She, her? Oh, cool. All right. Yeah.
No, I mean, look, never talked about in the media is the fact that the strongest candidate with Latinos is Bernie Sanders.
Right.
Never talked about.
You got that in on real time, which is great. Thank God. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
the number one candidate among black women, young black women, is Bernie Sanders. No one ever talks about that. So, look, you cannot like him. You can
exactly.
See, it's fine.
Right? I totally agree.
But like, let's be honest about who he appeals to and what his coalition is all about.
Yeah. And how he polls against Trump. Again, you can dislike the guy. I like Nader. He was not a good candidate. He was not a good campaigner. I like Sanders. He is good at those things. You know, like, again, we can separate out whether you like someone and whether they're good, whether they run well against someone else.
Exactly. Yeah. And the polling that shows Joe Biden doing well against Trump is taken very seriously.
Right.
And the polling, all of the same polling that shows Bernie also doing equally well against Trump is just 100% dismissed.
Yeah, it's just you can't. It's too early for polls, or you can't rely on polls, or that's what they said in 2016. And yeah,
and you wrote about this too, where the whole idea of you talk about how economic progressivism and cultural progressivism, how we the party has it kind of backwards, that they lead with one and kind of try to get to the other. But you talk about how they want to sort of tweak the message rather than actually adopt new policies. They're looking for a new way to score, right, on the economic progressivism front without actually delivering.
Yeah.
Is that kind of what you're saying? Like they think it's a marketing problem,
yeah,
and not
totally
actually a political problem.
Yeah. Messaging, not policy, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I don't know how many rooms you sat in, but I sat in a lot of rooms after the 2016 election where there was a lot of discussion about how we rebrand the party.
Right.
Right. When the problem really isn't the branding. Honestly, people kind of know what the party's about. That was the problem.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
They were like, no, we get it. Y'all aren't really going to do anything for us. We totally understand that. So, you know, one of the things I believe a lot in, and is part of why I do talk about Sanders and his coalition, is that if we want to regain credibility, we need to put working class people actually at the center of our party as our leaders, as our messengers, as the people who are coming up with these policies and plans and telling us, like, this is what would work in my community and in my life. Like, actually, rather than just telling the working class what we're going to do for them, actually asking them what they would like and giving them the power to make that a reality for themselves and their community. So it's kind of a fundamental shift in thinking. So yeah, I think one of the fundamental differences between Sanders and Warren is he really trusts the working class to be in control of their own destiny. His fundamental proposition of his campaign is, I am going to change who has power in the country. Fundamental proposition of Warren's campaign is, I'm going to come up with a plan to help you. That's different. That means you still get to control the rules and hold on to power. And that's why, like, her cups are selling out in the Hamptons, right? The quintessential home of the elites, because they know that there will still be a check. They will still fundamentally have the same power structure in place. And that's a much more comfortable thing for them.
I like Elizabeth Warren, especially when during the financial crisis. I mean, she was much more literate on a lot of these issues than most other politicians were. But this whole, I have a plan for that. My issue with it is more about the political efficacy of it, because it's exactly as you're saying, it's sort of a cult of worship of experts and expertise and sort of technocratic excellence and all that. And what that speaks to is what the Democratic Party doesn't realize is that people hate experts. You know, out there in where their electorate is, what people don't have any contact with billionaires or CEOs of companies, but they do meet all the time, lawyers and, people who run their schools, who run their middle management and companies, and they hate those people, right? And so I don't understand this urge to run as an expert who's going to give you advice on things. Isn't that what people hate?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the way it seems to me.
I think that's very well said, Matt. I think it's not fair to compare Elizabeth Warren to Hillary Clinton, in this way, they are similar. They're in the same model as John Kerry and Al Gore and all these other Democrats that white liberals absolutely love, who are super smart and have all the details and have all the plans put together and struggle to connect outside of the Democratic Party.
Right. She actually said, I don't know if you heard this, but she gave a speech at Washington Square Park Monday, which is where I saw Bernie a couple years ago. And she talked about the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory and mentioned Frances Perkins, who was more of a reformer. That's a whole other issue, how she chose to mention her as opposed to like Rose Schneiderman. But what she said was, she talked about Frances Perkins and how this tragedy helped spark certain reforms. She said, so what did one woman, one very persistent woman, backed up by millions of people across this country, get done? Social Security, unemployment insurance, abolition of child labor, minimum wage, the right to join a union, even the very existence of the weekend. Big structural change, one woman and millions of people to back her up, which I thought is very kind of speaks to what you're talking about in terms of being kind of like a more horizontal movement connected person, which is what Sanders says, right? Not me, us, versus the way she's framing it.
Yeah, and I think you can tell a lot by who people are courting and who they surround themselves and the way they go about obtaining power. She's made a choice to tell the Democratic establishment that she's going to be a team player, that she's just like Sanders in terms of all the great policies everyone loves, but, you know, she's going to play nice and not color outside the lines. When, you know, my fundamental view is that we need to not play nice, that the party that she wants to be a team player with is a big part of the reason that we're here. I mean, they're NAFTA, they're TPP, they're a financial bailout for the banks and screwing over homeowners and no bankers ultimately going to prison. So I want a candidate who is willing to break with that and fundamentally transform the party to be something different than what it's been over these last years.
Right.
You've also had a really interesting journey. I mean, obviously you run for Congress, but you've been in the media. You've been, you worked at MSNBC. You're now at The Hill. I'm just curious, what's your take on how the media environment, the business has changed, especially in the last few years? I mean, I think I know the answer to this, but I'm curious to hear your view on it.
Yeah, I think Trump has made people lose their minds a little bit. Mm-hmm. And obviously, for good reason, mind you. But, you know, the media, it is fundamentally driven by a profit motive. He's been very good for ratings as he was rising, and he's continued to mostly be very good for ratings. So there's this absolute fixation on his every insanity to the exclusion of a lot of other things, right? And there's also part of this playing to the white affluent liberal is a lot of hand-wringing about his breaking the norms and guardrails of our democracy, which, honestly, as a progressive, it's the one thing about Trump that may end up being good. I mean, if you just want big change, a lot of those norms and guardrails are basically bullshit put in place to keep people in line,
right?
Frankly. So, you know, I'm just not as, like, concerned about his tone on Twitter.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people say they're concerned about, a lot of people actually really love that about him, that he's just like absurd and doesn't care and doesn't follow the rules, because those rules have screwed a lot of people over. So I think that's part of why there's a very distinct mismatch between what's focused on in the media and what actually matters to people in the country. I've talked a lot about, you know, I have a little bit of a different view on impeachment, I think, than a lot. I think if you're going to pursue impeachment, which I honestly think at this point the Democrats have waited too long and dicked around and it's too late, but if you're going to do it, people think D.C. is all corrupt. Yes, Trump is more brazen with it, but they're not impressed that his corruption is fundamentally different than all the rest of these people.
Right.
So it's not the corruption. They don't care what he said to Corey Lewandowski about Jeff Sessions in the Oval Office about Jim Comey. It's not some process thing on obstruction of justice. Like, go after him for the actual harm, right? The Muslim ban, institutionalized cruelty at the border, right? Helping to inspire and encourage a domestic terrorist movement. If you want to go after him, those are the things, that's at least a starting place to focus on, rather than the type of stories that are important. I'm not saying they're not, but are the utter fixation of most of the media to the exclusion of almost everything else.
Yeah. And do you want to talk at all about two things? GM, the GM strike. Also, you had a great monologue about the way that media nudging works and how you're encouraged to tell certain stories and not tell certain stories. And of course, you've been very critical of the role that MSNBC has played on the left. So those two things, I think, are related. Do you want to talk about those?
Yeah, I think that's good. I think, you know, to me, one of the most important and fundamentally undercover dynamics of our generation is the decline of the labor union, right? You can look at the charts and you can see as rates of unionization have declined, so has gone the middle class. The trend and the correlation is plain as day. And yet here we have, over the past couple of years, one of the largest movements, labor movements, uprisings across the country that we've ever seen. And I'm not saying it hasn't gotten covered at all, but this should be one of the stories of the year. So we had, of course, the teachers' movements across red America, which I covered and was on the ground for quite a bit when I was living in Kentucky at the time. I was working in West Virginia with Richard Ojeda. So I saw that up close. Normal, like, middle class white women taking this incredibly militant action, right? It was a crazy scene. And now we have GM going on strike. We have, with tens of thousands of workers, we have Kaiser Permanente in California has taken a strike vote. That would be the largest labor action in I think about 30 years. And you have airline caterers who have also nationwide taken a vote to strike. So you have all of this energy around the labor movement. Americans favor labor unions more than they ever have in our lifetime. And yet it gets very little. All the trends around that are covered very little. Most of the major papers don't even have labor reporters anymore, right? It's just not a focus. And again, this goes into, there's a huge class blind spot in the media. It's not nefarious. It's not a scheme. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's just a reality of who populates the newsrooms, who they're surrounded with, and who their audience that they're ultimately playing to is. Who do advertisers want to reach? Right. Affluent white liberals, most by and large. And so that's who the coverage is ultimately playing towards.
I mean, isn't part of that have to do with who physically the people in the press are? I mean, in the old days, you had people who were working class in origin in the media. You had the Mike Royko style voices, right? Jimmy Breslin. Those people don't really exist anymore in the national press anyway. I mean, they do in the local media, but for the most part in the op-ed pages, you're not finding that those kinds of voices anymore.
Except for Brett Stevens.
Right, yeah, exactly.
Salt of the Earth Stevens.
Salt of the Earth, yeah. But
yeah, I think that's an excellent point. I mean, just in my own little career, when I started at The Cycle and we're a panel show of four people, I was the only one of the four who was not from the Boston area. So just to give you, like, and I love them all. They're all wonderful. But like, just to give you a sense of how insular it is, very rare that you find someone who actually came up from a blue collar working class background at all, or, you know, has a real sort of sense of rural America, red America, or any perspective that is outside of that kind of liberal, urban, neoliberal world.
What was your upbringing like?
Mine is funny. I grew up in this really rural small town, King George County, Virginia. And the whole economy is centered around a naval base. So it's kind of like the closest to socialism you can get in America. Right. Like everybody worked on the base. That's what it was.
And do you have siblings who also have names that are puns? Is that what you would call it? A crystal ball? Is that a pun?
I do have two older sisters. Their names are entirely normal.
Okay.
Paul and Heidi. If you want the whole name story while we're on it, because people always want to know. First of all, it really is my name. My parents really did name me that. They are so straight-edged. Like, they're not weird hippies or anything. You would never. They're just, like, bourgeois middle-class people. But my dad is a physicist, and so he had done his PhD dissertation on crystals.
Oh, wow.
They liked the name.
That's
there
cool.
you go. Wow.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Great story.
Well, thanks for coming on.
Yes,
thanks for
helping
in your car and driving to a place where there's broadband access and talking to us for a little bit today.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Congrats on the podcast,
thanks.
Guys. I really do love it. And thanks for having me. It's an honor.
Yeah, excellent. And you have to come on the show when you're in New York.
I would love that. Yeah. We will make it happen.
Great.
Excellent. Thanks so
thanks
much.
So much.
Take care, Crystal.
Right. Bye, guys.
Bye. That was great.
Thanks for listening to Useful Idiots.
Yes. Make sure you rate and review us on iTunes, subscribe to us, find us on Spotify. And if you're on YouTube watching this, subscribe to our videos.
Mm-hmm. Mike Carruthers shares little pieces of intel and interviews you can use to improve your life on the Something You Should Know podcast.
The next time you're looking for a job and have to write a cover letter, here's some advice from Skip Freeman, author of a book called Headhunter's Hiring Secrets. Add a P.S. to the bottom of that cover letter. That can actually increase the chances of that letter being read by up to 75%. Some people actually glance down and read the P.S. first.
Something You Should Know. Search on YouTube or wherever you listen.